There were a lot of known gangsters from the database right in front of me. Doing research on the faces I saw, I realized some of them were involved in human smuggling. The local police had records of this, and I had access to the records.
Via Europol?
Yes. My work involves tracking the proceeds of organized crime, and the sexual slavery market is the third largest criminal enterprise on Earth. Behind drugs and counterfeiting, and ahead of weapons. So I do know quite a bit about that world.
The world your sister got herself involved in. Talissa looks out the window for a moment. With a little anger in her voice, the first emotion I've heard other than fear, she says,
"She wasn't involved in that world. She was just a college student, a kid."
I let it go. "Your work at Europol, you're not a cop. You're a bean counter?"
"I'm a forensic accountant, a data analyst."
"A bean counter," I repeat. "And yet, there you were, following mobsters through a foreign city, alone. Very brave." I want to say it's braver than she appears now, but I catch myself. I did just see her preparing to attempt a solo entry on the home of an armed police officer with two bodyguards, so I realize I should probably give her more credit. She dismisses my comment with a wave.
"I was able to ID most of the men there, but there were a few not in the database. I took pictures of them, ran them through facial recognition, and discovered the identity of one of them."
"Niko Vukovic, Mostar Police." She corrects me.
"Captain Niko Vukovic, Chief of the Mostar Police."
She wipes away the last of her tears. Either she is comforted to talk about this with someone, or else she is fully absorbed crafting a make-believe story for me.
"The next day, Vukovic was back there, with a bus and some other men in cars. The bus had plates from Bosnia and Herzegovina. They all drove off on the highway to the west. I began to think maybe Roxana had been kidnapped by the smugglers and not killed. I thought that if this was about smuggling women, Bosnia is the next country to the west of Serbia. Perhaps this policeman was involved in whatever happened to my sister, and she was on the bus."
With only half the doubt I'm feeling in my voice, I say, "You, a woman who didn't see three big Hungarian hitmen standing 30 meters from her. You, an accountant, no less, personally and single-handedly followed a convoy of vehicles all the way across two countries for 400 kilometers.
"Of course not. I didn't follow them. Instead, I flew directly to Mostar and waited for Vukovic to show up back to work, which he did 2 days later."
"Why did you do that if you didn't know what was in the bus?" A long pause now, then.
"There were women in the bus."
"You saw them?" She looks away. It's tough to tell if her distrust in me is what's leading her delays in answering, or if she's just making this shit up as she goes along.
"Yes. Just a few girls getting into the vehicle. They looked scared, exhausted. But I'm sure there were others in that bus."
"Why do you think that?"
"Because the windows were blacked out with paper. They were hiding something. Why a bus if they weren't hiding people?"
"How big was the vehicle?"
"A commercial Daewoo. I looked it up. It has seating for 30.
She may not have a mind for tradecraft on the streets, but she does have a hell of a mind. Both Ratko Babic and Liliana Brinza had said there were about 25 girls at the Mostar farmhouse. And while I didn't take the time to count heads, I estimated roughly that number myself. 25 women and girls, along with a few guards, would just fit in a bus of that size. So, for the first time, a part of her story checks out with my own knowledge. She says,
"I knew I would lose the girls if I followed Vukovic, but I thought I could make him tell me where they were taken."
Her head droops, and I wonder if she's about to cry again. "And you brought a gun?"
"I bought it on the street in Belgrade. I don't even know if it works. I'm afraid to test it."
"Your plan was to do what exactly?"
"I wanted to get into his house, wave the gun in his face, intimidate him.
I don't want to insult her by telling her she wouldn't intimidate me if she waved a flamethrower in my face, so instead I say, "Your plan is dangerous. He's got security around him, day and night, apparently."
"Yes."
"So your idea won't work." She looks up at me now.
"Apparently not, because I've been kidnapped by a gangster."
"Kidnapped?" I ask in surprise. Then consider the fact that I have a Glock 19 pistol on my knee, pointed vaguely in her direction. I holster it, but say, "I haven't searched you, so if you make any sudden moves, we're going to have a problem. But otherwise, I have no intentions of hurting you. Looks like you've been through enough already, and I'm not a damn gangster." Holstering the gun seems to calm her down, but I can tell she still sees me as a potential enemy. I drum my fingers on my leg a moment, then say, "Here's my problem with your story, Talissa. You can lie about what you've been doing for the last week. You can fake your entire timeline, but you can't fake the smell of terror that is pouring off you right now. You look like you haven't slept in a week. How am I supposed to believe you took on the Belgrade mob all by yourself, and you're in the middle of a one-woman op against the head of the police here, a man who has armed bodyguards and a man you say is tied to the mob? How the hell are you able to—"
"Because of Roxana! Because she's my sister! Because I'm all she has!"
Talissa screams it.
"She is either dead or she's their prisoner. But either way, I have to find her, or find out who killed her."
She begins weeping again.
"I have to."
If this part of her story is an act, it's a damn good one. Through her sobs, she asks,
"What is your name?"
"Harry."
"Harry what?"
"Just Harry."
"Let me ask you, Harry, whoever you are. Have you ever lost a loved one? Someone you cared about more than anyone in the world?"
"Yes, I have, more or less. But I don't answer her. Still, I think about this. Think about the anguish I felt back then. And I dial back my skepticism about her story. Okay, there's more to you than meets the eye, I can believe that." Sniffing back more tears, she nods.
"But you're right. Pointing a gun at the captain will probably just get me killed."
"And even if it doesn't, with that crazy bright red hair of yours, it won't be long before the opposition IDs you, realizes you're following them, and then they will grab you."
They've already identified me in Belgrade."
"I was wondering how a girl like this was able to tail mobsters without getting made. Apparently she wasn't."
"As the bus was leaving, I tried to get the license plate number, so I stepped out in the street. They had a truck following the bus. I didn't know."
"A chase car," I say. "Pretty standard stuff."
"Yes, it chased after me, but I managed to get on a streetcar and get away. I don't know if they told others what I looked like and what I was doing, but—"
"Trust me, they did. I look at her hair. Let me guess. After you were blown, you dyed your hair thinking it would throw them off."
"Yes."
I want to laugh, but this shit isn't funny. "And to make sure you would blend in with the crowd, you chose candy apple red? Is that it?" She runs a hand through her hair self-consciously.
I didn't know it would look like this. I've never dyed my hair before."
I let it go. It is a damn miracle this girl is still alive with her non-existent tradecraft. But she is. Beginner's luck is a thing. But in my experience, it's nothing to bet your life on. I say, "You are blown. You're absolutely and positively compromised to the enemy."
"But I have to—"
"No. Trust me. You are done with field work. But there is another way forward."
"What do you mean?"
"I haven't been compromised. Not yet, anyway. I can snatch Vukovic instead of you."
"Snatch? Is that like capture?"
"Yep."
"But you are a one-man operation as well, correct?"
"Yes, but this is kind of what I do. No offense, Talissa, but I'm guessing you're a first-timer." She looks at me for a moment, and I hate it when people look at me. Finally, she says,
"For what purpose do you want, Captain Vukovic?"
"I want to know where the women are." She looks up at me.
"One of them, she is close to you?"
I shake my head. I have a reason, but that's not it.
"And when you have Vukovic, you will interrogate him?"
I think, sure, that's one word for it. "Exactly," I say out loud, knowing well that she and I probably have wildly divergent definitions of the word interrogate. Korbu gazes out the car windshield down at the city a moment, and then she finally nods.
"I help you. I know about the sex trafficking business. I know how the industry operates, how the money is moved. It is my job. I can help with the interrogation."
"All right, then. Let's do this together," I say. And I wonder suddenly if she's going to have the stomach for what will happen next. 11. Kostas Kostopoulos looked out over the Adriatic Sea as the first hues of dawn cast flickers on the gently breaking waves. He'd only been up for a few minutes, hadn't yet bothered his cook to bring him his first coffee of the morning. He was awake now, earlier than usual, because he was waiting to hear news from Mostar. He'd spent the previous day on the phone arranging the hit on the chief of police and having the area searched for the gray man. The 72-year-old Greek did not like dissatisfying his superiors with bad news that came out of events taking place in his territory. Kostopoulos knew his place. He was king of the consortium here in the Balkans, but he wasn't one of the consortium's top leadership. And just as he'd sent Hungarians to take out the police captain, the consortium could always send assets from all around the globe to come after him if they chose to do so. Not that he expected them to. No. Kostopoulos was certain that once Vukovic was dead, the way station was completely sanitized, and a new way station, already under development in Banja Luka, opened for business, that the matter would be forgotten. But first things first. He needed to know that the three Hungarians had completed their mission, and so far, he'd heard nothing. Just then, the phone rang on the tiled table in front of him. Looking at it, he saw it was his contact with the Potoczi Mafia, the Slovakian organization that provided Hungarian assassins. Kostopoulos answered.
"It's done?"
The man said,
"I just got a call from them. The team failed. All three men were injured and they are fleeing right now."
The Greek shouted into the phone, all pretense of control lost.
"Imbeciles!"
"They claim they were attacked by someone unrelated to Vukovic. He was an American, alone."
"Just like at the way station," Kostopoulos thought. The Slovakian added,
"They say the man had incredible skill."
"Just like at the way station." Slowly, a panic began welling inside him, and he lashed out at the man on the other end of the phone.
"Of course they would say that if he beat their asses, wouldn't they?"
He sat there for a moment, took control of his anger, and suppressed his new fear about the fallout from above from all this. Finally, he asked,
"What happened?" "I only know what I told you. We are already sending another team. 8 men. They'll be in Mostar late tonight. They'll take out Vukovic at the first opportunity, and they'll know to keep an eye out for this American."
Kostopoulos hung up and thought about the assassin. Belgrade assumed he'd come to kill Bobic, but Bobic was dead, and now the man was still in the area, targeting the men who were there to kill Vukovic. What on earth for? The Greek sex trafficker looked out over the Adriatic again and found it suddenly less beautiful, more ominous. A vessel would arrive here in Var the day after tomorrow. He would board, and then they would head down the coast where they would pick up the merchandise. Then he, along with the merchandise, would continue to the next stop in the pipeline, where most of the items would be sold off to other groups. Everything was still functioning in the system. But Kostopoulos couldn't shake the worry that this American, whoever the fuck he was, would show up again. He reached for his phone and dialed the number for his contact with the consortium. It was a call he didn't want to make, but it was also a call he knew better than to avoid.
"Yako, it's Kostas. I'm afraid we have more bad news,"
It was 6 a.m. when Talissa Korbu sat down at the little table in the apartment and lifted the jezva, a small copper pitcher. She poured thick Bosnian coffee into a chipped ceramic vessel the size of an espresso cup. She would have liked some cream and sugar with it, but she'd only found the coffee set up and an old bag of ground roasted beans in a cabinet, along with 3 cups and a pair of spoons. She was glad to find these, actually, as the nearly barren cupboards in the tiny flat didn't offer up many more options. As she poured from the jezva, she noticed that her hands were trembling, and she thought it to be less the immediate fear and more the intense anxiety she had been feeling every waking moment for the past week and a half. Her quest for answers about what happened to her sister was taking a toll on her body. This much was clear to her. And last night, with the plan to confront an evil man, then her subsequent abduction, and then the gun in her face, these events hadn't helped her get over her anxiety either. She placed a second small cup on the table, and she looked back over her shoulder to see if she should fill it now with coffee or wait on the American to wake first. She saw him there in the darkness, lying curled up in a closet hardly designed to accommodate a full-sized man. What a strange individual. If she knew who he was, it would help her trust him. But if she simply knew what he wanted, what his aim was in all this, then she would at least breathe a little easier. Talissa had not known many good men in her life, and certainly none that were simultaneously as dangerous as this one. No. Nothing in her brain lined up right now. She looked at Harry again, watching him sleep. He'd been up most the night while she rested, and then a couple hours earlier when she woke, he told her he'd grab some rest. He'd taken her weapon with him into the closet, along with her phone. He'd left the door open so he could see her, and she had no doubt he was an incredibly light sleeper. It was odd to her, as scared as she was and as unsure about this man as she felt, that she had no desire to run. She'd been in over her head coming here to Bosnia in the first place. And she also knew in the back of her mind that it was simply a matter of time before one of the evil men involved with Roxana's abduction would spot her, and then it would be all over for her too. She was scared of this Harry, and she certainly didn't trust him. But she knew she needed him. He could go places she could not, and he most definitely could do things she could not. Talissa wasn't above using a bad man to help her navigate her way through bad men. She'd do anything to resolve the situation, which is why the evening before she had told the American a series of lies about what had happened. Harry simply couldn't learn the truth, because if he did know, then she worried he'd be no help to her at all. I wake up in the closet again in my Mostar flat and see that dawn is just now breaking outside. A soft rain falls outside the window. The events of the evening before rush back into my mind like a flood, and I turn to look for Talissa Korbu. I find her sitting in the living area, in the same chair and at the same little wooden table where Liliana and I sat the day before yesterday. She's wearing jeans and a dark blue pullover, just staring out the window at the weather. Or at the police station across the street. I can't tell which. She still looks like a little girl to me, freshly dyed red hair and small mousy features, pale skin and tired but fearful eyes. She's got balls of steel coming here alone to find out who killed her sister. I'll give her that much. I smell coffee, and this is a surprise because I didn't know I had any coffee. I close my eyes and ask myself what I'm going to do. I'd spent a couple hours before falling asleep trying to figure out the best way to grab Vukovic without a rolling gun battle through the middle of town. My plan to take him late at night after he got home from work had been a good one. So good, apparently, that 4 other people had been planning on trying it themselves. But the nighttime kidnapping option is off the table now. I don't want to stick around Mostar all day to wait for him to come back home. The Hungarians will have already reported into their leadership, so there might well be another vanload of assholes already on the highway heading down here. Nope. I've got to do this today, at the first opportunity. And I don't think Korbu will be much help. She's a bean counter, not a cop. And that means I'll have to do this shit alone. Why should today be any different, I think. I shake off my moodiness, climb up to my feet, and walk over to the Romanian. She pours me a cup from a little copper pitcher she must have found in a cupboard in the kitchen. I sit down and sip the hot coffee, and it's strong and good, better than I could have made. I'm no aficionado, but to me it tastes like Turkish coffee, something I'm very familiar with. Her first words of the day to me are,
"You sleep in closets?"
I shrug. I'm weird. She doesn't reply. I know she's still trying to get some kind of a fix on me. Her analytical brain hasn't put me together yet, and it's twisting her in knots. After sitting together in silence for a moment, I say, "I'm going to roll him up during the day today."
"Roll him up?"
"Capture." Korbu is surprised.
"While he is working? While he is armed?"
"Everybody I meet is armed."
"I'm not armed. You took my gun."
I sigh. "Every bad guy I meet is armed." The woman seemed to marvel at what I was planning on doing. Then,
"How can I help you do it?"
"You won't be there, not when it happens anyway. But I need a place to take him, somewhere outside the center of town. You can help me find a suitable location."
"The place in the hills where we parked last night?"
"Not there exactly, too close to the road, but up in the hills for sure. Go back in the woods on the other side of the street from the overlook. See if you can find a building or a clearing or some barn. I need it to be well hidden."
"So you can question him."
And now we've come to the moment of truth. Clearing my throat, I say, "Talissa, your idea of an interrogation probably differs from mine. I know men like this, Vukovic, and I know what he will be able to resist. I also know what he'll respond to. We're going to have to do this my way to get anything out of him." Talissa cocks her head.
You are saying you're going to torture him?"
"There's a good chance he won't tell us anything if we ask nicely, which means this is going to get ugly. If you don't want to be around to see it, I get it. I'll ask him questions about your sister's murder if you want me to."
"Her disappearance,"
she corrects. "That's what I meant." I can hear fresh nerves in her voice now.
"Are you going to kill him when you have the information?"
She thinks I'm a bad man, and she thinks I'm nuts. Yet still, she seems all too eager to receive my help. "I'm not going to kill him," I say, but I know I might be lying. There are a lot of ways that this can go down. It will be a violent encounter when I take him, and if that son of a bitch draws on me, I'm going to put a couple of rounds through his heart and end him. But I'm doing my best to keep Talissa on board because I need her help. Her continued suspicion is evident.
"I still don't know who you are, Harry."
"I'm the guy here to screw with the people who run the pipeline."
"But why? Why do you care? Did they kill your sister too?"
She says it sarcastically, but I can tell she needs to know something. "No. I think about making up a story, but decide against it. This girl is being straight with me, more or less. Not completely. I know there is still a missing piece to her narrative, but I haven't pushed her about it yet. Still, she deserves some truth. 2 nights ago, I went to a farm 30 kilometers from here. I was doing a thing. But I discovered a room full of sex trafficking victims. They wouldn't leave with me, afraid of what would happen to their families back home. I think there is a chance the women will be punished for me showing up there. And I can't just walk away from that. I need to try to help them somehow." She seems astonished by what I just told her.
"The way station? You found the way station here? You saw the women?"
"I did." Korbu reaches quickly across the table to where her jacket lies over a chair and shoves her hand into a side pocket. Startled by the rapid movement, I rise to my feet, spin towards her, and go for the pistol inside my waistband on my right hip, all in one motion. I draw faster than her hand comes out. "Don't pull it," I say with authority. I don't know what it is, but she's going for something, obviously, and I'm trained to do whatever's necessary to avoid surprises. She freezes solid, and the poor girl looks like she's about to wet herself. In a stuttering voice, she says,
It's just a picture. I want to show you a picture."
"A picture." "Bring it out slowly." The hand comes out. There is a palm-sized photo in it, and I holster the gun. As Korobu offers it to me, she eyes my Glock, now back on my hip. She asks,
"What kind of thing were you doing at that farm?"
"The kind of thing you really don't want to ask about."
"Were you trying to rescue the women?"
I shake my head. She looks me in the eyes and registers my intensity, and she doesn't ask me for any more details. As I take the picture from her, she says,
"My sister, Roxana."
Korobu's voice turns hopeful now.
"Did you see her there? Anyone who looked like her? She doesn't usually wear so much makeup, but this is the most recent photo I have. A cousin's wedding in Timișoara in May."
Before I even look, I say, "The Serbian told your mother she was dead." I watch pain in her face reappear, clouding over her new excitement.
"Yes, I guess I am just holding out a little hope that..."
I get it. Hope isn't a strategy, as my mentor Maurice used to say, but it does go a long way in helping us deny the awful truth. I look down at the image now. Two women stand at a party in flowing dresses, a flute of champagne in each one's hand. At first, I don't recognize Talissa on the left. She has longer dishwater blonde hair in the photo, and now her hair is dyed red and cut shoulder length. And she's wearing makeup, while now her face is unadorned. She's by no means unattractive, but she's relatively plain, her features all but nondescript. Kind of like me, I guess. Plus, it takes me a moment to associate the dressed-up, confident, happy woman in the picture with the buttoned-up, terrified, exhausted woman seated in front of me. But next to her in the photo, I see another woman. She is stunning. Beyond stunning. She doesn't even look real. Talissa says,
"I know what you are thinking. We don't look like sisters."
"I wasn't thinking that," I say, but in truth, that's exactly what I was thinking. Roxana's features are all soft, her eyes large, her lips full. Where Talissa has blonde hair, this woman is a brunette, and she is easily 4 inches taller than Talissa.
"We have different fathers, and she's 6 years younger than me."
Looking over the photo, I feel sure I've never seen Roxana before in my life. I'd remember someone who looked like that, I'm certain. But I keep staring in silence for a few seconds. I really don't remember any of the faces I saw in the cellar. I only remember Liliana. She is Moldovan, and she looks nothing like the girl in this photo. "I'm sorry, I didn't see her. But it was dark and there were a lot of girls in the..."
"Never mind. She's dead. I know she's dead. I keep telling myself not to think about finding her alive."
She pauses.
"The only thing I can realistically hope to find are her killers. Maybe they will lead me to her body."
She looks at me with suddenly fierce eyes.
"I'll find you a place to take Vukovic. It will be far from the road, far from people, and covered."
With a cold smile, she adds,
"He can scream all he wants, and nobody will come to save him."
I raise my eyebrows. "You're starting to get the hang of this." 12. Captain Niko Vukovic ran the police force in Mostar, but that wasn't where he made his money. He was paid by the Serbian mafia in Belgrade for a number of things, but his main income came from assisting the flow of trafficked humans from the east on their way to the west, the Middle East, and even Asia. Vukovic didn't know the scope of the operation in which he played a part. No, he was a big fish in a small pond, and his pond was Mostar. Here, as far as he was concerned, he was in command. Not that old general who'd run the way station until the night before last, but the police captain who had kept the pipeline open through the territory for the past several years. After Bobic's obviously politically motivated assassination, Vukovic worried that those involved in the pipeline would hold him accountable, even though his job was not to provide physical security for the general, but rather safe passage of the women on the roads to and from the way station, and police coordination if something went wrong. Still, The first thing he did when he heard about the attack on the farm was to assign himself four of his best officers to act as a security detail. The four all took money from the Bronjevo partisans, the Belgrade mob, same as Vukovic. He figured they could be trusted to watch over him, both during his regular police work and when escorting him to a restaurant frequented by one of his Serbian mob contacts on the second floor of a small hotel on Stari Pazar Street. The hotel was in the hilly old town at a cobblestoned intersection a block from the swiftly flowing Neretva River. It was luxurious by local standards, and the neat lobby was nearly empty. He walked up the stairs with his entourage to the restaurant and found it all but deserted as well. It was late for lunch, but early for dinner, his preferred meeting time with his contact. He saw a heavy-set, silver-maned man alone in a back booth on his phone with a bottle of Serbian liquor in front of him. Vukovic nodded. Always here by four, just like clockwork. The police chief entered with his four officers. He directed them to stay by the front door of the restaurant while he headed to the back.
Zdravo, Filip.
Hello, Filip, Vukovic said as he sat down.
Haven't heard from you. Time for a quick chat?
The Serbian mobster gave him a half nod, then finished his call and poured Vukovic a drink. They toasted without much emotion, then drank down their shots in silence. Another round was poured and drunk, and then a third poured into the little glasses. But instead of picking it up and downing it, Vukovic said,
I'm sure your people in Belgrade have spoken to someone in the consortium.
Filip just nodded.
What do they say? What you'd expect. The consortium is mad at us, mad at Babic, and mad at you.
The police chief did expect this, but he also knew he had to push back against it.
You told them I didn't have men providing security at the way station, didn't you? That was not my role. Yeah, I told them. Look, this will blow over, but they are moving the way station. It's already closed.
Shit,
Vukovic said, but he wasn't really surprised. The man from Belgrade added,
The whores were taken to Dubrovnik. They're going to filter the next batch of product from Sarajevo to Banja Luka.
Banja Luka? That's out of my territory.
What can I say? The consortium makes those decisions.
What about me?
The man with the silver hair shrugged.
What about you?
After a moment he said,
Look, we've got other jobs around here. We're not cutting you off. Are those other jobs going to pay as much as I was getting from the pipeline?
The mob official shook his head.
You were getting Western money for that. Sorry, Nico. But that gold mine is shut down now. Be glad the consortium didn't tell us to terminate you.
In a raised voice, he said,
Terminate me? It wasn't my fucking fault. They know that, right?
Another shrug from Filip. He didn't seem to care. Then he softened.
Look, Nico, you've been good for us here. Belgrade does not blame you for this. We aren't going to hold it against you. But the consortium, they demand everything run perfectly, all the time.
Your people aren't going to come after me, but what about someone else?
The Serbian mobster nodded to the four cops at the front of the restaurant.
Just keep those boys close for a few weeks. I'm sure things will settle down by then.
Vukovic shut his eyes, squeezed his glass hard, and down the rest of his drink. Banging the empty vessel back on the table, he said,
I have more to say. Don't go anywhere. I'm going to take a piss.
Filip nodded and grabbed his phone to make another call. Vukovic stood and waved over one of his men, and together they ambled to the stairs to go to the toilets on the ground floor of the hotel. The police officer entered the restroom before his chief, his hand on the CZ pistol he wore on his utility belt, while he checked the area. The first three stalls were empty, but he pushed on the door to the last one and found it locked. In Serbo-Croatian, he said,
Police business! I need you out of here!
Soon the toilet flushed, and behind the cop, Niko Vukovic stood in the doorway. The cop cautioned him with a raised hand.
One second, sir.
Wanting to check the hotel guest who had been using the toilet, the cop kept his right hand on his pistol and his left hand up, signaling his boss to wait. The stall door flew open, and before the cop could react, he registered a black semi-auto pistol a foot from his nose. A man in a ski mask came out quickly and pointed a second weapon at the chief. Niko Vukovic did not move, other than to raise his hands slowly. I rush out of the stall with my weapon pointed at the cop, then train the stainless steel semi-auto on Niko standing at the door. When I can tell neither man is going for his weapons, I shove my Glock in my waistband and yank the checkmate pistol out of the cop's holster, racking the slide against my belt buckle to make sure the guy had a round chambered. A bullet ejects and falls to the floor, and then I point the cop's own gun back at him. Both men are frozen in place, and this makes me happy. I know what I'm doing. Speed, surprise, and violence of action will win most violent encounters without the need to fire a shot. To the cop, I shout through the fabric of my mask. Drop your radio and phone on the floor and pull out your handcuffs. Lock yourself to the shitter. The guy doesn't speak English, apparently, and he just stares at me. I look to Vukovic, motion for him to enter the bathroom all the way and to close the door behind him. When he does this, I tell him, if you don't speak my language, you've got 5 seconds to learn it before I shoot you both. Instantly, the chief answers in a heavy accent.
What you want?
For you to tell him what I just told him. He speaks to his subordinate, nods as if to give him permission. I move out of the way to the John, and the cop reluctantly enters the stall, then handcuffs himself to the pipe going into the cistern. I kick his radio and phone across the bathroom, and they come to rest under the sink. Then I order Vukovic to remove his own radio, but let him keep his phone. He does so. I check the cop kneeling over the toilet and see that he's clasped the handcuffs as instructed, and all the while I keep Cordobu's little pistol pointed at the police chief. When the cop is secure, I put the crappy gun in my back pocket and shift the CZ to Vukovic. Turn around. As the chief turns, he says,
Are you from the consortium?
I have no idea what he's talking about, but he doesn't need to know that. So I don't answer. He follows that with,
Whoever you are, this is my territory, not yours. You throwing your life away today.
I close on him fast, spin him around, take him by the back of the neck, and jab the pistol in his kidney. I kick open the door, then start hustling the Mostar police chief quickly through the ground floor of the hotel. There's not much activity around, but the few people in the lobby see me instantly. Everyone freezes in shock, and I scan each person I see to evaluate if they're a threat. A hotel security man slowly starts to open his coat, but I train the gun on him, and he raises his hands. In 15 seconds, we are out the employee-only utility door that I used to enter the hotel, and on a quiet old-town side street. I shove Vukovic into the front passenger seat of my Jeep, then rush around to the other side and leap in. I'm driving as soon as I get behind the wheel, my gun on the Bosnian Serb next to me. I don't make it 50 feet before I glance into the rear view and see two of his bodyguards racing out the front of the entrance to the hotel, heading directly for their SUV. I slash the tires on the police vehicle parked on the side street near me, but didn't do anything to the police vehicle sitting out front, because I couldn't chance being spotted by any of the hotel staff standing around the entrance. They call me the Gray Man, but this shit's not magic. I'm low profile. I'm not invisible. The police vehicle lights up and sirens wail, and it falls into hot pursuit behind me. Vukovic looks in the passenger side mirror now and sees his men behind us.
You let me go, and you keep running. They will not chase you.
I speed through the center of the hilly town with no idea where I'm heading. It's tough holding a gun on a passenger while driving one-handed, and I clip the mirror off a parked panel truck during a left turn. I look to Vukovic, then tap the cell phone on his belt with the barrel of the 9mm.
Call them! Tell them to back off or you're gonna get shot!
It's nearly impossible controlling the Jeep at these speeds, and I know the cops behind me are already radioing to others with instructions to cut me off ahead. My only chance is to get Vukovic's help in having them end the chase, and then get out of town before all the other police of Mostar rain down on me. But Vukovic doesn't move, He looks at me without fear and speaks calmly, because he knows I'm after information, and I won't kill him. He says,
"You are going to die."
I move the gun from his temple to his knee, and I press it there. "Maybe, but first, you are going to limp."
"What?"
"I need information from you. I can still get it from a one-legged man." Vukovic looks at the weapon, taking stock of his predicament now, and I see a slight crack in his visage, the first real hint of concern. He pulls out his phone, hits a button, and brings it to his ear. I speak fair Russian, better Spanish, a little German and French, and some Portuguese, and I've picked up a dozen phrases in Serbo-Croatian, but I can't understand a word of what this guy's saying now. I look at him while he talks, hoping to give him the false impression I have a clue, but it makes racing through these tight, narrow streets even more dicey. He starts yelling into the phone, and I tag another parked vehicle, sideswiping the little two-door with my left rear quarter panel. My tires scrape a curb on a turn as he ends the call. Looking in the rear view, I'm relieved to see the police vehicle behind me slowing down. It turns off down a deeply sloped side street a moment later. With the barrel still on Vukovic's knee, I ask,
"Can they track your phone?"
"No."
It's impossible for me to tell for certain if he is being truthful or not, so I take his phone and throw it out the window anyway. In times like this, it pays to be a dick.
"What do you want?"
he asks, but we have some more housekeeping to attend to before we get down to all that. I move the gun off his knee.
"Put your handcuffs on, behind your back."
In response, he just says,
"You are the man who shot Babik. The Branyevo partisans are going to kill you for that. You need to be running for your life, not talking to me."
I move the CZ back to his temple now, and with a sigh designed to show me he's a tough guy who isn't scared, he pulls out his cuffs and puts them on. I break the keychain off his belt and toss it out the window so he can't unlock himself, and I let him stew silently in the fear hidden behind his false bravado as I drive up and into the hills. 13. We make it out of the city without any more problems, and Talisa Korbu calls and directs me to the place she found for the interrogation. After driving around a bit more to make damn sure no one is on my tail, I follow her directions. When I get there, I muscle the jeep into deep foliage off the road till it's hidden, then park it and pull out my prisoner. I'd put a black hood over Nico's head as soon as we were out of the city, and this, along with his hands cuffed behind his back, makes him utterly compliant. It's work getting up this hill through these trees, which means Talisa has done a good job of finding an out-of-the-way spot. I get lost for a minute, but the young Romanian woman calls me and talks me back on track. And 10 minutes after climbing out of the jeep with the chief, I see the location. It's a concrete bunker from the Bosnian Civil War, mostly covered in vines and brush, pockmarked with bullet holes and RPG strikes. Still, the structure is remarkably intact. I shove Vukovic inside. Rain drips through blast holes in the concrete above my head, openings that give some light to the otherwise dark space. The walls are covered with graffiti. The words Red Star, the name of a soccer team, are emblazoned in red. Tito is written in spray paint all over the place, which surprises me because he was president of Yugoslavia a long time ago. He's been dead for 40 years, and he was an asshole back when he was alive. Weird that kids around here take the time to tag bunkers with his name. Talisa Korbu stands in the middle of the dim space in her raincoat, the hood over her red hair, and a scarf tied over the lower half of her face, just as I instructed her. I pull a spare handcuff key from where it's stitched behind my belt loop at the back of my pants, kept there just in case, and I unlock my prisoner, then re-secure his hands over his head, attached to a bent rebar sticking through one of the mortar holes. I leave him there, the bag still over his head, while Korbu and I step outside the bunker and speak in whispers. "This place will work fine." I see now in the outside light that her eyes are filled with terror and concern, and she speaks in a voice tinged with trepidation.
Any problems?
I know what she is asking by this.
Nobody got killed. Obvious relief washes over her, but I see her lower lip continue to tremble.
What now?
Now is the ugly part. I won't know how ugly till I get started. You want to wait out here?
Of course not. I need to be in there listening to what he says. But please do not torture him first. Give him an opportunity to tell the truth.
She's so out of her element right now. It speaks volumes about her relationship with her sister that she's doing all this, but I worry about bumping up against her limits soon, perhaps in the next 5 minutes. I'll start gentle, but what's gentle for me probably won't be considered gentle by you. I will use something called the presumptive. It means that although we don't know everything, we're going to come at him like we do. I'll lead. I'll tell him we know he's with the pipeline and the consortium.
The consortium?
In the car, he asked me if I was sent by the consortium. Does that mean anything to you? She shakes her head and looks back at the entrance to the bunker.
What about me? What do you want me to do?
You just whisper in my ear if you have something to say. She nods her assent, although she remains incredibly reluctant about all this. I return to my captive and hear him muttering something in Serbo-Croatian. I don't know what the hell he's saying, but I don't like it. I smack him on the side of the head, and he shuts up. Talissa gasps in surprise behind me.
You better speak English, Nico. Otherwise, the only language we can communicate in is pain.
He switches to English, and again he says,
You the man that killed Bobik, yes?
After a little chuckle, he says,
Some bad people looking for you.
Where are the women?
Who are you? What do you want?
I didn't go through all this shit to get interviewed, so I don't answer. Instead, I repeat,
Where are the women?
Now he replies with,
What women?
And I punch him in the jaw. I know it hurts because I've gotten my own face bashed in a time or two. Talissa gasps again. Vukovic grunts, and his head shakes inside the hood. After a moment, it begins to hang. He's not unconscious, he's just showing signs of defeat, coming to the frightening realization that his future depends on me. It gives me some slim hope that I won't have to pound on him all day. The women and girls who were locked in the cellar of Ratko Bobic's house. Where were they taken? He spits inside the bag, and bloody phlegm drips out of it, down onto the tunic of his uniform. I ask with more authority in my voice.
Where were they taken?
They gone. I don't know where. I don't know what happens before Mostar. I don't know what happens after Mostar.
Talissa Korbu surprises me by stepping forward and shouting now.
Liar! I saw you in Belgrade with the Branjevo partisans. You picked up the girls, brought them to the farm near Mostar.
His head cocks to the side. Perhaps he's surprised to hear a woman's voice, but he makes no reply. I lean closer to his face.
Oh, shit, Nico. You're lying to me. I guess it's time to knock your block off.
I punch him again. It's not a particularly hard blow, but I am pacing myself. Still, my right hand throbs with pain, and I think I'm going to have to look around for something else to bang against his face if this goes on much longer. More blood and spit drip out of the bag. Korbu has stepped back against the graffiti-covered wall, apparently surprising even herself with her outburst. I say,
Okay. If you know about Belgrade, the previous stop in the pipeline, then I bet you know about the next stop.
His head shakes hard.
They tell me nothing. Belgrade is Serb mafia, like here. That's why I go there. I work with them. The next stop, it is different group.
What group?
I don't know.
Where does the pipeline lead?
Nico just shrugs.
I don't know. The men who run it. They are somewhere else. I do not know. Not mob.
The bag stops moving, and it appears he is thinking for a moment. Then he says,
I don't think mob. Not Serbian. All I know, it is business. Only business.
Only business, I say with growing rage, and I realize I have to smack this asshole again. But this time, Korbu beats me to the punch. Literally. She appears on my left, charging forward, and she throws a crazy haymaker at Vukovic's head. The Romanian woman hits the Serb in the cheekbone, and I can tell by the sound of the impact that Talisa Korbu is going to feel the strike a lot longer than Niko Vukovic. She clutches her hand in pain, and I'm certain she's regretting the first and only punch she's ever thrown in her life. I pull her back a few feet. Let me handle the rough stuff. Ignoring her injury, she says,
My sister!
She pulls out the photo and gives it to me with her uninjured hand. I return to the police chief again. I need you to look at a picture of a girl, and I need you to tell me truthfully if you have seen her. He snorts a laugh.
One of the whores? That's what you want? One of the whores? She's not a whore,
Talisa shouts, and she rushes forward again, swinging the same fist as before. I catch it before she makes contact, not for the prisoner's benefit, but for hers, and I spin her around and walk her back to the corner. Allow me, I say, and I walk forward now and hammer Vukovic's face with a left jab. Speaking to Talisa, he says,
They are all whores, like you, whore.
I slug him harder now, connect with his right cheekbone. His head pops back, and I know he's going to feel that all the way down his spine, because I feel it all the way up to my shoulder. As his head hangs again, I say, I'm going to show you a picture.
Who cares? Who cares about this woman?
I do. Which means you'd better care, too. I put my balaclava back on and yank off his hood. He looks at the picture without any emotion as blood runs from his nose and mouth.
Never seen her,
he says. I can't tell if he's being truthful, but I push him. You're lying again, and you're trying my patience. He shakes his head once more.
No, I don't have time to look at all the property.
I bet he takes time to do more than that with the prisoners. I ball up a fist, but calm myself and hold it back, deciding to try another tactic. Taking the picture from him, I say, You are worried about what I will do to you now, but maybe you should worry about whoever it was who sent the Hungarians after you. He looks at me with confusion, his nose and mouth dripping blood.
Hungarians?
Three assassins were outside your building last night. I stopped them before they got to you. When he says nothing, I add, You're welcome.
Lie, he says. I have no problem with Hungarians.
I could be wrong, I say. But I'm guessing someone high above you in all this wants to send a message to other little people in the pipeline about the price of failure. They brought these guys in from another gang. Niko does not respond for a long time. Finally, he whispers,
Petovci.
Talisa leans into my ear and whispers,
Slovakian mafia, from up north in Bratislava.
How do you know this?
When I worked for the Romanian Federal Prosecutor's Office, we dealt with them. They are active in Bucharest.
To Vukovic, I say. But the Slovakian mafia didn't order the hit on you, did they? Somebody else is pulling their strings. He doesn't respond. It was the consortium, wasn't it? I don't know what the hell the consortium is, but again, I'm doing a presumptive interrogation approach, and sometimes it requires taking a chance. His eyes rise to mine, and I know I've struck gold. I'm completely improvising now. They aren't happy with you after what went down on the general's farm. You are being made an example of, and then, after you've been brushed aside, you will be replaced. He looks away, sniffing bloody air, but I press him. Time is short, Niko. The Slovakians will send more killers, and I won't be there to beat them up for you. Somebody wants you dead, Chief, and it's the exact same people you've been serving. I'm inside his head now. I can see it.
What are you going to do to me?
He asks. You have three choices. I can kill you right here, I can take you back home to where the next hitters from the Pitovtsi are probably already waiting, or I can just leave you here alive. Number one and number two both sound like more fun to me, but I'll do number three if you give me something valuable to help us find those girls. Blood bubbles on his lips as he thinks.
I know one thing, only one thing. I tell you the truth, all the truth I know. And you will leave me here, alive?
I lean into his ear and speak softly. I am a man of my word. If you believe I'll kill you because I said I will, you should believe I'll let you go if I say I will. He hangs there and bleeds a moment while he weighs his options. He nods a little and starts to speak. I interrupt with, "Remember, it better be really fucking helpful." Finally, he just says,
"Dubrovnik."
I cock my head. "Dubrovnik?
It's a city in Croatia.
I know that, dipshit. What about it?"
"From Mostar, the whores go to Dubrovnik."
"How do you know?"
"My men escort the trucks that come, then lead them to the Croatian border. They take the southern route through the mountains. It goes to Dubrovnik."
"Where in Dubrovnik?"
"I don't know."
"Not that helpful, Slick." He shouts now, fear and anger in equal measures in his tone.
"It's all I know. It's everything I have."
Talissa speaks up again.
"That's not a small town. How are we supposed to find them there?"
Vukovic's head hangs again.
"I have no answers. I don't work in a pipeline. I just protect it here."
"I see. And you've done one hell of a fine job, haven't you?" He looks up at my masked face, but not in anger. It's more a look of resignation. I wonder if he knows he's a dead man, no matter if I spare him right now or not. This fact seriously hampers my ability to extract any more intel from him, but I have to try. "Tell me about the consortium." With his head still low, he gives it up.
"They run the pipeline. They deal with Branyevo partisans. Partisans deal with me. That it. That everything."
He seems like he's telling the truth. And I walk back to Talissa. "How's the hand?"
"It's fine."
She's rubbing it still. "It isn't fine." I say, "This is all we're going to get out of this guy."
"What happens to him now?"
There are nerves in her voice, and I take that to mean she's worried I'm going to just shoot my prisoner in the head and leave him hanging here like a piece of meat at the butcher shop. Honestly, I like the imagery, but I need Talissa, and I need her with her wits about her. "We're leaving him here, alive. We'll take your vehicle. Mine's been compromised."
"But how will we find the women?"
"We'll discuss that on the way." We leave Niko Vukovic with his arms over his head. I don't hand him the key. I do, however, pull my jeep back down to the street and leave it there alongside the road. His people will find him soon enough, and they will release him. Then, judging from the look on his face when he realized the consortium had targeted him, I assume the consortium's people will find him, and then they will murder him. And I, for one, won't miss him. We head south from Mostar, the terrified young Romanian criminal investigator looking for information about her sister's disappearance, and me, an assassin on a poorly thought-out quest to make up for my mistakes. We're a strange pair, to be sure, but for now, anyway, we have the same goal. It's quiet. A fresh, gentle rain falls from the low, gray summer sky. I look over to Talissa. She's rubbing her hand. I don't see the woman who threw the punch in the bunker. I see the scared, young accountant. "How did you start working for Europol?" She looks out the window as she talks.
"I received an advanced degree in forensic accounting. I started working in economic crimes for the state prosecutor in Bucharest. After a few years, I applied to Europol. Now, I live in The Hague and work in money laundering crime in the European Union."
"And sex trafficking?"
"At the prosecutor's office in Romania.
Following the money from the international criminal enterprises to the local gangs was a big part of my work. Hundreds, thousands of young women disappear every year in my country. They are trafficked and smuggled abroad, forced into prostitution, used as slaves, dehumanized. We could see the money making its way into the gangsters' accounts, but it was laundered somehow, and we could never see where it came from. I moved to Europol thinking I could make a difference on a bigger level, but my office is not so interested in human trafficking. It's seen as a law enforcement problem, not a forensic accounting problem. They are wrong, of course, but I am still very junior, and no one listens to me.
Allison, I want to understand what the consortium is.
I have never heard the term when related to trafficking, but a consortium is just an association of organizations.
How does all this work, typically? Where are the victims taken?
They are taken to any place where the economy can support a large commercial sex industry. The developed nations, Europe, America, wealthier parts of the Middle East and Asia.
How are they taken?
Many different ways. But victimization is all about vulnerability. Statistics say 90% of sex trafficking victims suffer some kind of abuse before they are recruited. Sexual abuse, physical abuse, dire economic hardship, often all three.
What do you mean by recruited?
An unfair term, I agree, but that's the term. It encompasses all the ways they are brought into the trafficking system. First, there are recruiters. These are usually women, and they make initial contact with the intended victim. Typically, this is called the grooming period. The recruiter uses money, flattery, and the like to get the victim pulled in. They make connections with them to earn their trust. And then, when they are more susceptible, transporters are brought in.
To this, I just say, the pipeline.
Exactly. Vukovic said the Serbs passed them off. I imagine whoever they pass them off to passes them off again. Finally, they will be sold into slavery.
Do they ever escape?
Sometimes. Not terribly often. But if they escape their captors in a foreign country, they are treated like illegal immigrants by the local governments. They have no rights. They are just shipped home. There is no witness protection, so if they say anything to the cops, the traffickers will know. The sad part is that many who escape return home to the same hardships they were drawn away from. Women and girls are often re-victimized, time and again.
I think of Liliana Brinza, and I hope this doesn't happen to her again. Christ, I say.
The people running the pipelines and other systems like it have this down to an art. The way stations are hellholes, but they are also refuges. Food, music, the bonds made between the captors and women, the drugs administered to them. It's all part of the plan. These young women and girls go into a system that has been honed for hundreds of years. Thousands of years.
And here I am getting in the middle of all this. She sighs loudly now, then asks,
how can we possibly locate them in a city the size of Dubrovnik?
I have an idea, but you may not like it.
Anything. I'll do anything to find out who is responsible.
I was hoping you might say that. I breathe out a long sigh, knowing this idea isn't great, but it's all I have. We use you as bait. She looks up at me slowly as I drive.
Bait?
Look, the cops have been tainted at each stop on the pipeline, not just here in Mostar, but in the other locations as well.
Yes.
I can tell she gets it.
So you are saying I go to the police in Dubrovnik and start asking questions?
Exactly.
About my sister?
I wouldn't do that. If there is one chance in 100 she could still be alive, you will endanger her by letting the opposition know you are looking for her. She just may become too incriminating for them to keep around. Talissa thinks about this for a long time.
I can't do that. I think she is gone, but without a body. I don't know for sure, so what do I say?
Tell them you know about the pipeline, and you know about the consortium.
But what do I know about the consortium?
Nothing, really, beyond the name. Throw that out there, ad lib, like I did back there with Nico.
And then what?
Then return to your hotel and let me take over. They'll come for you, I'll get you out before they take you, and then I'll be there to see who they are and where they go. She sits in silence a moment. I start to waffle. I even consider telling her we'll think of something else because this is too dangerous. But I know there is nothing else. She knows this too.
Yes, that is the best idea.
Not sure it's the best idea, Talissa, but it's pretty much the only idea I have.
When do we leave for Dubrovnik?
I've turned on the highway through high hills towards mountains in the south. We'll be there in a few hours. She nods, and we drive on. I've made it out to her like our plan will be much easier than I envision things, because if Dubrovnik is in fact the next stop along the pipeline, the people who run this thing are going to be looking for us there. The same guy, me, shot up one of their way stations and then snatched one of their police conspirators, so it's no great leap to assume I'll turn up again at the next stop in the line. If they normally had 5 guys with guns around the girls, now they will have 15. If they would normally send 2 guys to pick up Talissa when they realize she's onto them, now they will send 6. My involvement in this whole thing has made it more difficult for everyone, victim, friend, and foe alike. Nice work, Gentry. This is going to get complicated, and it's just me and the accountant with the missing sister against an opposition we haven't even identified yet. Yeah. Any way you look at it, this blows. 14. Kenneth Cage sat in a plastic chair, staring at the girl dancing in front of him. She moved with grace, but with a look of intensity on her face that would tip off an expert that she was struggling to remember her moves. She stopped and bowed, and the crowd clapped politely. Ken Cage, on the other hand, stood up and cheered. Juliet was his 12-year-old daughter, after all, and as far as he was concerned, she was magnificent. Soon he sat back down and watched the next girl at his daughter's ballet recital take the stage. He knew he'd be stuck here for another hour, but just as he steeled himself to endure the rest of the damn dancing, his phone vibrated in his pocket. Heather glared at him as he looked down to it. But when he saw who was calling, he turned away from her and left the room. His bodyguard moved into position behind him, radioing the driver of the Mercedes outside that the principal was moving. But Cage didn't go to the G-Wagen. Out in front of the Hollywood dance studio, he moved over to a bench and answered the phone in an angry tone, while his bodyguard remained a few feet behind.
"Not the best time, Yako.
Sir, I need this encrypted."
The American sighed, tapped a couple of keys that encrypted the call on his end, and said,
"What's up now?"
"It's about the Balkans."
"I told you to handle that. I need someone who can make a decision, sir."
Cage sat on a bench by the parking lot, his head sagged.
"Damn it,"
he said, while looking around to make certain no one was in earshot.
"What's the fucking problem now?"
Yako's voice was its usual business-like tone.
"It was thought the killings in Bosnia were associated with an assassination attempt on the man running the way station. Something unrelated to the pipeline.
Some Uber assassin, right?"
"Yes, sir. But if that were the case, we'd expect that man to be long gone from the area where the killings happened. And we'd also expect him to pose no more threat to the pipeline. But by all reports, the man who killed Bobek the other day also killed the mobster chief police this afternoon, local time."
The American replied with, "And why does that interest me in the slightest?"
"Because Chief Niko Vukovic worked for the pipeline."
Cage felt hot anger welling within him.
"So, you are saying someone is fucking with my operation?"
"It seems that way, sir."
The entire police force in the Mostar area is looking for their chief, of course. So I hope to have news before long. If he's recovered alive, then he's been grabbed by an assassin. Finding him alive doesn't sound very likely now, does it?
No, sir.
But even if he isn't recovered alive, we can hope for clues. Obviously, the cops will turn the area upside down looking for the assassin, whether he keeps Vukovic or kills him and dumps the body. Cage said, "Is this something Kostopoulos can handle?"
"No, sir. I know a lot about this mysterious gray man. He's just too good. What is it you want from me?"
"I want to get my team together. Fly into Dubrovnik, the next stop in the pipeline. It will take some time. My men are spread out all over the world right now. But we'll get in there and protect the shipment. Keep an eye out for this American bastard."
Cage waved a hand in the air.
"Approved. If the Greek and his Albanians can't get it done, then it's up to you and your boys. I'll be at the market in Venice in 2 days. I sure as hell don't want this maniac showing up there. This gets dealt with now, and it gets dealt with hard. Got it?"
The pause was short, and the reply bore all the deference of a military man serving his master.
"Yes, sir. I'll get the boys together."
Kenneth Cage hung up his phone, shaking his head in disgust. He wasn't worried about his overall operation in the slightest. It was strong and secure, and the men, women, and organizations under him in the consortium would do what needed to be done. No, he was bothered by the fact that his day had been sullied with talk of hitmen and kidnappings. Cage didn't consider himself a criminal, just one hell of a good businessman. A partner in a Hollywood production company valued north of $800 million, he was also senior partner in a hedge fund with assets under management 7 times that. With a business degree from Wharton, he'd gone into banking in the 80s and computer programming in the 90s. He had been at the vanguard of virtually all the advances that technology had brought to the finance industry in the past 3 decades. And he'd made a name for himself, and a fortune along with it, exploiting the markets with the latest electronic tools. He created and managed a hedge fund at the height of the dot-com bubble, but with the bust, his fortunes evaporated overnight. This hit him hard, not because his investors lost mightily, but because he'd grown accustomed to both the lifestyle and the sense of personal power that came along with his riches. After a single lean year, he decided, without a moment's guilt or indecision, that he would regain his stature by any means necessary. Cage used his vast skill set in computers and finance to begin laundering money. First, for the doctors and lawyers who were his hard-hit fund's clients, helping them to protect endangered assets from their wives, their business partners, and Uncle Sam. But soon he developed both tactics and processes that could clean dirty money on a much larger scale. By the stock market crash of 07, he found himself recession-proof because he was hard at work for drug cartels, third-world dictators, high-end corporate and government embezzlers, even revolutionary and terrorist organizations, along with a host of other shady clients. Through his efforts, aircraft and even cargo ships full of palletized cash were turned into sound legal assets, and though he'd gone to great lengths to keep himself safe and out of the eyes of the police, those in the underworld knew that there was a shadowy man in the United States who could get their massive amounts of currency turned into heavy balances held in untraceable offshore accounts or into hard assets like property, luxury cars, and jewelry. Cage had the brains, the know-how, and the sheer creativity necessary for his work, and he loved it as passionately as he loved Heather and his 3 kids. For the first several years that he worked in illegal finance, he was more than satisfied to play the exciting shell game of money laundering, and play it better than anyone else. And though he was a dedicated family man while at home, he began to enjoy his role on the periphery of the underworld when away. This wasn't hard for him, as his work introduced him to the top criminal industries on Earth: drug trafficking, weapons trafficking, and human trafficking. An organization out of the Middle East that trafficked women from all over Asia and Eastern Europe into Western Europe employed his creative financial services, and on a trip to Marseille, Cage had been offered a taste of their wares. Cage enjoyed the power he saw in himself while subjugating and abusing the young women. It made him feel virile and potent, and soon he tweaked his illicit business model to cater specifically to this industry so he could be more involved with human bondage. He didn't traffic drugs or weapons himself, not because he had any moral aversion to doing so, but rather because that was not where his interests lay. He was a businessman, obsessed with the allure of expanding his realm. But though he might have had more money with drugs and weapons, he never ran the numbers to find out. It didn't matter, because Ken Cage's heart and soul were in sex slavery. Within a few years, he led a large organization without a name. It was referred to among the players simply as the Consortium. He'd made arrangements with over 24 other regional organizations around the globe, mafia groups in Turkey, Slovakia, Serbia, Greece, Italy, Belarus, and Ukraine, and criminal gangs in Germany, France, the UK, Belgium, Spain, and the United States. He also developed, along with advice of the experts in the target regions, systems for finding and bringing the best product to market. Albanian, Belarusian, and Ukrainian recruiters who snatched or coerced women and sold them into the pipeline. The American mastermind saw himself as an overseer of a process and the inventor of a brilliant, efficient, well-oiled machine. Together, the organizations and assets of his consortium now accounted by his Money Cruncher's recent estimations for roughly 6% of the world's $150 billion annual human trafficking revenue. $10 billion a year filtered into the consortium's component parts, and the cash and the consortium's share of the world's supply of slaves was growing in double digits. It was real money. Men and women would kill to get it, and to protect it from any threat to the consortium. And men and women had killed to do just that. Whether through assassinations, turf wars, or executions of slaves who either could not work or would not hold their tongues about the pipeline, the violence associated with the organization was truly staggering. And this was in addition to the rape, the humiliation, and subjugation of human beings, and the theft of liberty and labor that took place as a matter of course in the day-to-day operations of the consortium. Police had been bought off. High government functionaries in developing nations had been corrupted. Ken Cage had started it all, retained ultimate control over much of the oversight, but just as he had a rule that his involvement was hidden behind dozens of shell companies, he also had a rule that he would never, ever sully himself with violence. He had others do that for him. Not only in the form of his security force, Jaco Verdun's small but specialized unit of well-trained Afrikaner shock troops, but every single organization that assisted along the pipeline had their own killers and captors, corruptors and enforcers. MS-13, Indrangheta, the Gulf Cartel, the Petovci, the Branyevo Partisans. The names of the gangs and cartels and the other criminal concerns had meant nothing but news headlines to Cage before he started his process. But now, they were integral to his own success. The American in the Hollywood Hills was a supervillain masquerading as an everyman, albeit an outrageously wealthy one, and no one who saw him on the streets of L.A. would ever have a clue that the short and bald middle-aged man had almost single-handedly created a massive worldwide organization of abject misery. That was by design. Cage compartmentalized his criminal behavior and his home life. And nothing was more vital to him than keeping those two worlds apart. He took trips every 4 months or so to different source locations to personally pick out his own stable of girls and had them recruited by any means necessary and brought over to a large property owned by one of his offshores north of L.A., where he would travel to sample the best of his product. He'd expanded the ranch into a compound of sorts, had it staffed with a